Hello and welcome to the first hour of Nationwide Discussion with me, Sunny Martin. We are coming to you live from Juba. And today we are going to be discussing how to address trauma in South Sudan's security sector, the challenges and solution. And that's what we are going to be discussing and examining the issue of trauma. And trauma, as I said, in the security sector in South Sudan, and how it affects the performance and well-being of the personnel, and what kind of support is being given to them. And to discuss all this, I am joined here in the studio and also online from Geneva and Madrid this evening to discuss this very important discussion. I am joined by Dan Hales, who is the co-author of the Guide on Assessing and Addressing Trauma in the Security Sector, the CAF, in Geneva, Center for Security Sector Governance. Good evening, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening. It's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, and I am also joined by Ann Bennett, who is the head of Africa Americas Division at the CAF, Geneva Center for Security Sector Governance. And Ann, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Okay, and here in the studio, I'm joined by Malice Godfrey, trauma healing specialist from the Center for Mind and Body Medicine. Good evening, Malice, and thank you so much for making your time.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here today.
And also I have with me here in the studio, Christina Rosati, a senior security sector reform officer at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan. Good evening, and thank you for coming also.
Thank you. Thank you for focusing on this topic.
Okay, and our lines will be open to you later on, where you can call on 091206-7879 or 091206-7929. You can also send us your question to our SMS number, 091-2177-141. Anne, let me begin with you. From an institutional and policy standpoint, why did the CAF see it as important to publish the Guide on Trauma in the Security Sector?
Thank you, Sani. Perhaps I can just start by telling the listeners, Mariah's listeners, who DCAF is. We're a Swiss organization that works to develop effective security institutions that are accountable to the state and to its citizens. So this work is called SSR, or Security Sector Reform. Some of you may have heard about it. And it takes us to many settings that are highly affected by conflict, such as South Sudan. So the main objective behind the publication we're discussing today is to better understand how trauma, or how more globally mental health and psychosocial support considerations intersect with the sort of institutional reforms that DCAF is accompanying in police or in armed forces or intelligence. So through this research and the consultations, and Dan will say a little bit more about that later, we identified trauma as a really relevant and under-addressed issue within security sector reform programming. So it's not only an important topic, but in many ways it's kind of the missing piece. Mm-hmm. You know, just to give an example, a few years ago, with our partners at the UN, DCAF carried out an assessment of the South Sudanese police, and you know, trauma didn't even figure in that. So we were really addressing, you know, the assessment from a very technical point of view in terms of delivery of services and you know, how the personnel were deployed, but not actually looking at those personnel and seeing how they were doing.
Okay. Yes, Dan, you also co-authored this guide and have worked extensively on the issue. For our listeners, how do you define trauma in the security sector context, and what are the key warnings and signs which we normally miss out?
Well, firstly, let me say, echo what Anne said. Thank you for inviting us. This is a really key topic that doesn't get discussed enough and is really essential for security institutions to understand. So starting off with what is trauma, it's important to say from the outset that trauma is a very normal response to abnormal situations.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very human response. It doesn't mean that someone is broken or weak. It's something that can happen to anybody. And it may not be one event. It may be a drip feed of several events. So if we look at security institutions that are in the field or even in the back office and maybe investigating, they're seeing potentially very, very traumatic images on a regular basis. They may be seeing violence. They may be engaging with witnesses who have had and victims who have had difficult times. And all of this can build up to become trauma. And what trauma does is it changes our brain patterns and the way we react and our reactions. So everyone has what we refer to as a window of tolerance that they can withstand when it comes to stress and pressure. So things happen to us all the time. But if it's within that window of tolerance, we can use our rational thinking to respond to whatever the situation is. Once this window of tolerance is stretched or maybe even broken, the nervous system takes over and moves us into the fight or flight mode. And this can stay with us longer term if it becomes longer term trauma. So if I use two examples to explain this, the first is if you're driving along in your car and a dog jumps out in the road, you will be quite stressed. You'll brake very, very quickly. And then after that, after the issue is gone, you'll calm again and go back to normal. But if you've had a traumatic experience or a car accident in the past, you may drive in a very different way. You may drive in a very hyper-vigilant way where you're constantly looking for it. And this can happen when it's applied to security institutions as well. So if we think about the one of the main interactions that can be part of a conflict between security institutions and the public is use of force. We can design use of force models, systems, and guides, but if someone has had traumatic experiences around use of force or violence, it can put them into a state of hypervigilance, and they can be out in the field almost looking for violence, almost looking for problems, and again, be hypervigilant. And so that affects our decision-making, and it can affect our decision-making in a negative way. So it's also important to say that this affects individuals, but it can also affect organizations as a whole, as well as communities, which is why we must take this into consideration when we're designing projects and policies. In the guide itself, we have a quote from a police officer who says that I love my job, but it's making me sick. And we have to reflect on the fact that inside every uniform is a human being who has had different experiences and different trauma. So that's the bad news. The good news is it is treatable. It is solvable. And that's what the guide is designed to do. So the guide is designed intentionally to be a non-clinical guide. It's a practical guide that uses the four R's of trauma, which is around respond, or realize, recognize, respond, and resist. So the first one is around realize, which is really just understanding that trauma is an issue. It does affect security institutions. It affects their ability to deliver for communities. And it affects their ability to be effective. And we just have to open up and understand that this is something that is a priority and must be addressed. We then move into the recognized side of things, where we look at an internal assessment of how this is manifesting and how this is affecting security institutions before we move then on into respond, which is looking at different interventions and different projects that can be done almost instantly to try and help mitigate the impact of trauma. Before we move into the last one, which is resist, which is a longer term responses.
Yes, and before we hear from Malice and Christina here, Dan, you also co-authored this discussion, but the question is, how can this guide practically help commanders, policymakers, like you just mentioned, in the frontline officers to really help those officers who are in uniform to do the right thing and do counseling and all this kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a very good question. What we didn't want to do was design something that is a nice academic theoretic piece of work but can't be applied. So this is a very practical guide. So it really helps security institution leaders at all levels throughout the organization understand what trauma is, how it manifests, how it impacts on their organization. They can deliver an internal analysis. They can have some very specific evidence internally of how it affects, but it also offers lots of solutions. We're also very clear as well that the solutions aren't just to be bring in a whole team of psychologists and psychiatrists, because not everyone has the resources to do so. There has to be several interventions that are available that are cost neutral, that can be done immediately. So it offers a lot of responses and interventions that can be done. As I said, the main one for me, the initial step forward, is really changing the culture so you can have a conversation around trauma without a stigma, without a difficult conversation around, without, you know, understanding this shouldn't affect career progression, it shouldn't affect performance, responses and appraisals, and that everyone accepts that this is an issue we need to talk about. It then moves into specific interventions. So, for instance, there's mentoring, peer support, and lots of different interventions available that can be put in place immediately, and then longer-term ones around working with other government departments around how to support individuals in the organization.
Right. Yes, Malice, just briefly, maybe you can tell us just briefly about this, where you work, this trauma healing specialist from the Center of Mind and Body Medicine. It's my first time to hear that.
The Center for Mind and Body Medicine, it's an organization that is in the United States, but it has branches all over the world. It has a branch in Haiti, it has a branch in Ukraine, and then it has a branch in Africa. Recently, there's also a branch in Africa, which is, in Gaza, and then in Africa. So this Center for Mind and Body Medicine, it's founded by Dr. Jim Gordon in the United States. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So do you have an office here in Juba?
Yes. In South Sudan, we are located at Hainim, and also you can find us on our webpage, which is Center for Mind and Body Medicine Africa, or else on our Facebook page, Center for Mind and Body Medicine Africa.
Okay. And mental health and trauma response resources in South Sudan remains very limited. And the guide talks about window of tolerance, the range within which individuals can manage stress, think clearly, and also relate well to others. From your field of experience, what practical techniques such as breathing, mindfulness, community support, or emotional regulation can security personnel and even civilians use when professional help to maybe help them come out from those scenarios? I will give you a simple example. I know you live here in Juba. Some people have claimed that we South Sudanese are very hostile and everybody is traumatized in this country. That's what even some people have said that. So how do we go about that?
Well, thank you. See, our body works works in a system, and that system, there is a nerve system in our body. That nerve system, there are two nerve systems in our body. One is called sympathetic nerve system, and then the other one is called parasympathetic nerve system. This nerve system works automatic in our body without our response to it. Mm-hmm. The sympathetic nerve system works in a way that it responds to our stress and also in danger. In the following way, like it activates our flight or fight mode.
Like Dan said, when you are in the flight mode.
Yes, yes. And then it also increases our heart rate. It raises our blood pressure. It also stops digestion. It releases adrenaline in our body. For example, when you're sleeping at night and then you hear a loud noise, what will your body do? It will take you to fight or flight mode. It will increase also your heart rate. So this nerve system just works automatic. The other nerve system is called a parasympathetic nerve system. This parasympathetic nerve system acts as a brake into our system in a way that it slows down our heart rate, it lowers down our blood pressure, it improves our digestion, it promotes relaxation, and also it promotes our healing. So most of us here in South Sudan, we operate in a fight, flight, or freeze mode. This fight mode is where you can find most of us are very angry. Mm-hmm. There's so much aggression.
What are the dangers
of
this kind of flight mode?
Yes, the dangers of fight mode, it's where you find us, we are very aggressive. Mm-hmm. We are very confrontive to somebody. we always work in a way where we are very angry at somebody.
What are the signs, just to our listeners, the benefit for them? What are the signs? How will you identify that I am very aggressive from the way I speak, from the way I respond, or from the way I behave?
Yes, our body normal works in these three categories here in South Sudan. There's that fight mode, there's flight mode, and then there's freeze mode. Mm. In the flight mode, where you find yourself, you wanted to
escape. All these three exist in South Sudan.
All these three exist currently in South Sudan. And most of us out there, you will find yourself either you're in the flight mode, or else you're in the freeze mode, or else you're in the fight mode.
Okay.
Yes. In the freeze mode, where there's, you just wanted to sit down. There's always, you want to dissociate from people, you are feeling stuck. This is the freeze mode. And then as a result of this, you find that you are very depressed, your immunity system is weakened, you always have a problem of sleeping, there's diabetics, there's high rate of diabetics, there's high rate of blood pressures. Yeah. As a result of this, there's a high rate of suicide, murder, and violences here in South Sudan.
All right. Yes. We are told it's called death by suicide, right, Christina? Okay, let's come to you. How is ANMIS currently supporting trauma-sensitive security reform in this country, if at all there's one there?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I do think that this is a very important topic because the unrecognized trauma can be very detrimental to the work of security forces in the way that they interact with the public. And that's on both sides. Whereas we're talking about anger and rage and aggression, it might be the people of the public towards the security forces who are just trying to do their job, or it might be security forces themselves if they have these unresolved issues. And this has to do with suffering at the end of the day. So if I am suffering and I have not resolved my issues, I will usually try to make another person suffer if I'm not very conscious about what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. So one of the things that we're trying to, what UNMISS has done in support of this is, one of the most kind of specific examples is that we worked with the RTNLA, the Specialized Committee on Defense and Veterans Affairs, and we worked with them to hold a workshop on mental health and psychosocial support as it relates specifically to defense forces and veterans, but it would be equally applicable to police.
Yeah.
And the idea is to start to identify, including as part of the security sector transformation or progress that happens in South Sudan, and security sector, to say how can some of these issues be taken into account in the structure of the institutions, and how can we help people find what the resources they need so that they can be supported. And this is very important when it comes to security personnel, because they are the people who can, as we say, have the monopoly on the use of force, and that's why.
Okay. Yes, Anne, we just want to find out from you, from your finding, how widespread is the policy gap on trauma in security institutions globally and also in Africa, from your findings?
Thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, as I said, it's really a blind spot. We've been doing this work for 25 years, and it's evolved quite a bit from, you know, going from a very institutional focus to a, what we would call people-centric. So we start with the individual and we try to understand that individual's access to security and to justice. But as far as I know, there are very few programs that go beyond just sort of even the initial stages of raising awareness. That said, we're seeing an increased demand for this work. So we've been working with the federal police in Ethiopia, with some of their very specialized criminal investigation teams, for instance. And there's a real demand to address sort of, as Stan mentioned, this kind of ongoing exposure that investigators see when dealing with victims, when dealing with with evidence as well. We returned recently from Liberia, and as you know, Liberia had a long 15-year civil war and then a period security sector reform. But again, trauma was not really treated within that. There were some localized, I think, you know, we've seen with, as part of the transitional justice processes, often there were some reconciliation that was based on community practices, and we've seen that in Sierra Leone as well. But I think a sort of systematic identification already in the early stages of a scoping of a program, and then designing a program around the mental health needs of the institutions. We're really at the very beginning of that, and I hope that this kind of a radio program, which will already, you know, raise the issues and get us all thinking about it, will help us actually put our heads together with colleagues at UNMISS and think, well, how can we support a more trauma-informed approach to security sector transformation in South Sudan? You know, this program came on the heels of the news, and all you have to do is listen to the news to see how affected South Sudan, you know, the communities are by ongoing violence.
And are there examples apart from Liberia? Are there other countries South Sudan can learn from, apart from the example you have cited from Liberia?
Yeah, actually, maybe Dan, you can tell us a little bit about what we were doing in Honduras with the Honduran police, which is a concrete example that could really be built on for South Sudan.
Okay, yes, Dan, you can take it over.
Yes, happy to. Thanks, Anne. So in Honduras, we were working with the national police, and Honduras was unfortunately suffering a very high level of violence at that time. And the police were under-resourced across the country. And one of the things we put in place was a new use of force models and new use of force guides, and making sure that there was, you know, in-depth training around this, and making sure that we looked at this perception of risk. And one of the support mechanisms we put in place was working with the national police on a mentoring system, so that especially for the younger police, the newer recruits coming through, they could be mentored by older police officers coming at the higher ranks, who could actually discuss some of these issues with them. As I said at the beginning, it's a large part of this is just realizing and recognizing that this is an issue, and you can have a discussion around it. A lot of the time we expect our security institutions to be almost invincible and uncrackable, and there's often quite a lot of stigma allocated to trauma. And so by putting in place mentoring systems and peer support and allowing that discussion to be had, it really makes it available for all personnel to understand that they probably will be suffering from trauma at some point, and there is help available, and then they can access that help. There's then longer term approaches that can be put in place, but that at a very initial level is key to making that cultural shift to saying, trauma is an issue, we must deal with it, because it's affecting our welfare, but it's also affecting our effectiveness and our ability to support the community.
Right. And if you have just joined us right now, you're listening to Nationwide. My name is Annie Martin, and we are discussing how to address trauma in South Sudan's security sector, and also looking at the challenges and solution. And I have four of my guests here. I have Anne Bennett, who is on the line from Geneva. We also have Dan, and we have Malice Godfrey, and we have Christina Rosati. They're all here with me in the studio. You can call us on 091206-7879 or 091206-7929. Those are all our lines. Or you can prefer to send your questions to our SMS number, 091-2177-141. Those are all our lines. You can get in touch with us here and be part of our discussion this evening.
Radio Maria, your number one source of engaging dialogue, news, and entertainment.
Nationwide, we bring you latest current issues, discussions, and information. Nationwide on Radio Miraya.
Yes, our lines are now open. You can call us and ask your questions to four of my guests, and they will be in position to answer your questions. All, like I said, I have with me on the line from Geneva, Anne Bennett, who is the head of Africa Americas Division of the CAF in Geneva Center for Security Sector Governance. And I have Christina Rosati, Senior Security Sector Reform Officer at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan here in Juba. Malisa Godfrey, a Trauma Healing Specialist from the Center for Mind and Body Medicine. He said they have just opened here in Juba, and they're also working globally. And I have Dan Hales, co-author of the Guide on Assessing and Addressing Trauma in the Security Sector, the CAF, Geneva Center for Security Sector Governance. Our lines are now open. You can call us and be part of our discussion. Hello? Hello?
Peace Boy from Ezo. How are you healing widows?
Yes, what's the question? Hello? Okay. I think the line have just dropped. Hello?
Yes, good evening, Tani Martin, and greetings to the guest. This is Tanguji.
From Malakal?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I only have one question, and it will be answered by any...
Any of the guests.
Yes, any of the guests. My question is, given the long history of conflict in this country, in which some of our security forces have been on the front line for the last 43 years, from 1983 up to 2016, but it looks like there's nothing that is being done. So because even the number of psychiatrists we have in this country are few, even we don't have counseling centers, even the counselors are very few. What exactly that needs to be done to make sure that these aging people plus the young people that are joining this don't fall into trauma? Even some of them have gone into depression. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tango. Juliet from Malakal. And... you can also do the same by sending us your comment. I already have some questions coming in via here, our SMS number, but you can pick one or two more questions. Hello?
Good evening, Sande Mate.
Good evening to your name.
Thank you so much. Jacob Joseph from Juba.
Go ahead.
Thank you. As trauma healing is a concern, it has been an issue since the beginning of the conflict up today. Now, my simple question, if the international community and the people in the country want to do trauma healing, can you do trauma healing to someone that is hungry, someone that has no food?
Mm-hmm.
That is the question. What can be done for the soldiers to make sure they are also like other soldiers in the country,
okay,
like other security in East Africa?
All right. Thank you so much. Yes, those are some of the questions coming in here that I think Malisi will tackle that most of the time the soldiers are not well fed, and they go hungry for a long time. We have a couple of SMS coming in here. And this one says, my question is going to Dan. And he's an expert. How does a repeated exposure to violence affect decision-making in the security sector? That's from Deng in Juba. And another question is going to Malish in Juba. From your experience, are there gender-specific trauma experiences among male and female officers, which you have identified, if not here in South Sudan, but, for example, in Haiti? This is from Jackson in Juba. Another question says, again, to Dan. This is from Taban in Juba. What signs should commanders watch for to identify trauma in their personnel? That question is going to Dan. There is this one saying anyone can answer this question. What is the link between trauma, substance abuse, and indiscipline in the security sector, according to your finding? Anne can take on that. Yes, let's take these questions. Yes, Anne, maybe you can take the last question about the link between trauma, substance abuse and indiscipline in the security sector. From your finding as you authored that report, did you try to find out more about it? Or this is coming from Peter in Juba here. Yes, go
Thanks.
Ahead.
I'll try and answer. Try to answer Peter's question. You know, our approach was not as clinical psychologists, but more in terms of understanding the effect on the staff, the security sector staff, and the institutions. But there is a link, obviously, between stress and trauma and substance abuse, because that's a means that many people self-medicate to counter the effects of trauma, counter the feelings that they are having. And so, yeah, you'll see definitely a correlation there. And I think as Dan pointed out earlier, you know, we really are seeing the effect of when, you know, you ignore this issue, you do see high rates of, you know, of violence. You also see high rates of suicide. I think that was mentioned. So you have this repeated exposure to violence, to crisis, to institutional stress, and it can have a, you know, effect across your personal life, your you know, how you work as a, if you're in uniform, and how you engage with communities where you work. Thanks.
Okay. Yes, Dan, you had quite some questions. The signs commanders should watch out for to identify trauma within among their personnel. And yes, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. All really good questions. And I think there's quite a lot of link between those questions. I'll start off with what can repeated exposure and how can it affect decision making, I think, and then move into the others. So the repeated exposure, it can really affect decision making when it comes to how people engage with others, with their own colleagues and with the community as a whole. As I mentioned when I was talking before, especially when it comes to use of force, if someone has been affected by repeated exposure to high levels of violence, they are more likely to go into new situations expecting violence. And so therefore their reaction to violence will more than likely be increased use of force, or at least an escalated rapidity to use force. So these are really, really important to keep an eye on, because if we don't treat the trauma within the individual and within the organization, the security institution can end up using an escalated level of force, which then affects the community very adversely. And I think that also links to the signs that commanders should watch for. And I think, you know, the signs, as you may ask Anne there, substance abuse is something that can be used to shield and try to numb the feelings of trauma. Increased conflict between colleagues, increased conflict in the field, increased sick days as well. A lot of the time, people who have experienced trauma, they feel it physically. I think this is what Malesh was referring to as well. There's a very physical response to this sometimes. So there can be increased sick days, increased anxiety in colleagues, anger and outbursts as well. It can often come out in a very looking for conflict kind of way, and it could push people away. As we were talking earlier on about the fight or flight scenario and the freeze, as Malesh mentioned, if you see those signs in your staff, then it is highly probable that they may have suffered some trauma there. I just wanted to finish off as well with, there was a question about what can be done. And there's actually a lot that can be done. This is the purpose of the guide. So the guide is there to try and help understand, assess, and address trauma in security institutions. So there's a lot of recommendations and suggested interventions at the end of the guide that are not a huge cost to security institutions at all. As I said, the first one really is around understanding it and having an open discussion around it. But then there are very specific interventions around things like debriefings and really discussing what just happened in the field, giving people space, giving people leave time to decompress, leaders admitting that they have suffered trauma as well, so there's no stigma attached, internal communications, monitoring well-being, looking at access to mental health practitioners, if that is possible. And obviously, you know, looking to work with organizations like Malesh who can help on coping strategies. And often security institutions should be looking elsewhere, because they're not experts in this either. They're experts in security, not in trauma. Mm. So working with organizations in civil society working with UNMISS, with DCAF and organizations like Malish does is a real benefit to security institutions, because you're then sharing that information and knowledge around how to address trauma.
Okay. Yes, Malish, there was a question about lack of counselors in the country. Yes.
Well, thank you, Sani. Trauma is something that affects all of us, and healing is a personal journey. So when you discover yourself that you are really traumatized, so the next question is, what next? And then you need to find healing. So how can you find healing? So with Center for Mind and Body Medicine, some of the techniques that we use for healings, these are techniques that are not Greek or techniques that have been brought from somewhere. These techniques are within our culture, like shaking and dancing. Currently, we have been having a lot of cultural festivals where people go for 3 days, mm-hmm. just they go and they dance. And when you dance, you kind of feel like relief. Also, like in churches, sometimes there's that session where people just dance and sing. That is one of the ways that you can relieve also your trauma, because what happens out this trauma, it's been accumulated so much
so
into your
body.
So
does it require personal initiative and efforts?
Yes, trauma is, it requires personal initiatives. It requires you to identify yourself that I'm really traumatized and I need to heal, such that I stopped trauma from affecting my family. I stopped trauma from affecting my community, because when you're traumatized, you're going to affect your family. When you're traumatized, you're going to affect also your community. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with Center for Mind and Body Medicine, these techniques are within our hands, and these techniques requires your practice. So every day when you practice it, so you realize how much the weight that has been lifted off from yourself.
This takes us to the question about somebody who is hungry. How do I rehabilitate myself when I am hungry? Yes, Christina.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to speak to that. I want to mention that there was a study done a very long, long time ago in the United States that used volunteers who from the U.S. Army who volunteered to not have enough food. And they studied them, and they found that one of the things that happened was that the people got much, much angrier when they did not have enough food, which mm-hmm. makes sense. And I think that the difficulty is that, as you know, the problem with not having enough food also comes when there is a lot of violence and there cannot be farming or there cannot be the generation of food. That becomes a vicious cycle. But some of the things, the positive things we're doing, just to give you two examples, because I do think that, yes, the issue of food is very important. It's a basic need. And, the person is living in a very high state of stress at that point. So we're working with the prison service in South Sudan. We have what is known as green corrections, mm-hmm. where they're working on farming because the issue of food has also been a problem in the prisons. So that's one way in which they're finding help that way. And also in community violence reduction projects, we're also focusing on farming as well. So there are ways to definitely treat the food issue and, as part of that, perhaps treat some of the trauma issues.
Okay. And Dan, two more questions coming in here. This one is coming from, no name. It says, can trauma among security personnel contribute to excessive use of force or misconduct? That's no name, actually. Please, when you're sending, do tell us your name and where you are sending your comment or question from. And then there is another one going to Malish. It says, do we have a qualified trauma personnel in South Sudan who can help you in issues to do with mental health? This is from Jackson, also here in Juba again. I think Jackson is sending another message again. Yes, let's begin with you.
Yes, thank you, Sani. Let me answer Jackson. So what happens here in South Sudan, we don't have many practitioners of trauma and healing. Mm-hmm. Especially like for my case, I didn't study about trauma and healing. I studied finance. But in 2002, when I attended this training about trauma and healing from Center for Mind and Body Medicine, that's when I took up the initiative that I really need to come and help out my community. I really need to come out and help out my family. So from where I understand is we all need to come out collectively and help out our community. With Center for Mind and Body Medicine, the training that they does is they give you a training. This training will go for around 2 weeks. And after this training, you will become a trauma facilitator so that you will be able to help out your community.
Okay. Yes, Dan, can trauma among security personnel contribute to excessive use of force or misconduct?
Thank you. Just before I answer that, I think there was another question around gender-specific issues,
yes.
If I could just cover
for a moment.
There was, it's a really interesting question because there wasn't a massive amount of international studies on this when we were researching the paper. There are some, but they're very, very specific. One of the differences is the type of trauma experienced often, and then the reactions to trauma can be very different for males and females in the institution as well. So within the guide, when we're looking at the recognized aspects of doing the internal analysis, we make sure that gender influence is analyzed correctly because it's really important to see the differences. If there are differences, often there won't be, but there are often differences in reactions, access to help, etc. On the question around misconduct and use of force, can trauma increase the possibility of this? Well, the short answer is yes. You know, if we just go back to the type of signs to look for, substance abuse, conflict, increased sick days, increased anxiety, anger, and outbursts, all of these can have a direct impact on misconduct. The security institution staff, if they are feeling very traumatized, if they have increased anxiety, and especially things like increased anger, then this can become very disruptive to their performance. And this is why when we direct this guide towards security sector leaders, we are very clear that we're saying this is about welfare of staff, this is about welfare of the community, but it was also around effectiveness. You know, you invest as much as you can in training new staff and recruits to go through, and you want their performance to be as good as it can be because that's the return on your investment as a security sector leader. And if it's being affected by trauma and it's being affected with misconduct, with excessive use of force and with, you know, bad behavior, then actually you're losing out on that investment as well. So for leaders, we're really saying this is twofold. This is about welfare. This is about duty of care for your staff as individuals, but also about effectiveness and the ability to be able to perform that role as a security sector institution.
Okay. Yes, for the sake of our time, we are almost running out of time. We have to go for the news. Let me begin with you, Anne, as we conclude. What is the single most important step right now South Sudan should take to better address the issue of trauma in its security sector, given the vast experience you have worked there for more than 25 years in this area? So yes, what are the kind of steps you can recommend?
Thank you. And I think Christine has already described a really important initial step of raising awareness. And I think that that's first, you know, raising awareness of the topic of trauma and how that might manifest itself, in whether it's in the police or in the armed forces or in the intelligence services, to start that conversation. And then to provide the support like we have and others can to the Honduran police, for example, with helping them carry out their own assessment, with working with the leadership. And I think Dan made that point early on, and just how important it is for the leadership to understand that this is a vital issue for their institution and for their staff. So, you know, this, I hope today's program will really open up that door and that conversation and get all of us thinking about how we can better support the need really in South Sudan.
Okay, yes, Dan?
Very similar to what I answered, I think. You know, it's really important to open up the conversation. It's really important to understand that this is not talking about people who are weak or broken. Any of us can suffer trauma, especially in contexts like South Sudan. Really starting to lead from the top and be very clear and open that this is something that can happen to anyone. And then be open enough to bring in external knowledge, like organizations that Malish works for, like UNMISS, like DCAF, to say, actually, let's share knowledge and let's work together on this. and look at what can be done in the short term. As I mentioned before, things like, you know, debriefings, giving people space, communications. Lots of these things don't actually cost a huge amount of money or any money at all sometimes. They're just changing the way we work. Just looking at internal training is always useful so people can spot the signs, as one of the questions was referring to. And then looking at referral pathways. There are some agencies that exist. Manish, again, is a good example of those, where you can refer to, and making sure those referrals are done with no adverse impact on that person's career as well, because otherwise people will not access that help. And it's really important that they are supported to access help and not feel that it's a negative on their reputation.
Okay. Yes, Malice, finally, here in Juba, what are the next steps you are going to be taking to support those who may be willing to come and contact you? And even how do they get in touch with you?
Thank you, Sani. Let me just take you back. Here in Juba, Center for Minor Body Medicine did a training on trauma and healing at the military hospital where
in Giada.
Mm-hmm. We invited in the army officers, we invited in the doctors and the nurses.
What was the response like?
So the response is people really realize that all of us are traumatized, and then we just need to find a way of healing. So to all my listeners out there, just find a way of contacting Center for Minor Body Medicine, or go to our social media page, that is Facebook, Center for Minor Body Medicine Africa, and then you can contact us, send for us a message, and then we can see forward of how we can all work together for your healing.
Okay, yes, Christina, how is your department going to continue working? You have mentioned already the prison service, where you are helping them and trying to sensitize them about the issue of producing their own food.
Yes, I welcome any military or police or security sector institutions broadly. Like I mentioned, the committees in the TNLA. Anyone who is interested in having more support from us on this issue, to reach out to me, because we obviously, as has been mentioned, the leadership aspect is very important. So if people are interested, people in the security sector are interested in working on this more, they should please feel free to contact me.
Okay. Thank you so much. I would like to thank Dan and Anne Bennett, Christina Orozati and Malice Godfrey for your time this evening. We thank you so much for sparing your time to come and explain this very important topic to our listeners. We hope to speak to you some other time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. And with that, we have come to the end of the first hour discussion on Radio Mirror. The news is coming next at the top of the hour in English. And join me after the news for the second hour of Nationwide. Stay tuned.